You know, I was walking past a construction site this morning and I stopped to look at those massive steel I-beams they were hoisting up.
Right.
To the naked eye, they looked like the most boring, static things on Earth. Just big gray blocks of permanence.
That is the great illusion of steel. It's the poker face of material science.
The poker face, I like that.
It looks dead, but if you zoom in enough, it's incredibly alive.
That's exactly what I gathered from this stack of research you sent over. We are doing a deep dive today into a classic assessment from, what, 1985?
That's the one. HKDH Padatia from the University of Cambridge.
And the takeaway that hit me immediately is that if I could shrink myself down and sit inside that steel while it was cooling, it's not static at all. It's a war zone.
It really is. You have crystals fighting for space, atoms sprinting to escape, phases colliding.
And the reason we're talking about this paper, diffusion-controlled growth of ferrite plates in plain carbon steels. It isn't just to admire the chaos, is it?
No, not at all. It's because if we can't predict that chaos, we can't predict if a bridge stays up.
That's the mission, right? Prediction.
Exactly.
Because reading through this, it seems like the holy grail of physical metallurgy is to be able to look at a chemical composition and just say, okay, if I weld this, here's exactly how strong it will be.
Precisely. We want to predict the microstructure of the weld deposit before we even pour the metal. But in the mid-80s, there was a massive problem.
The math wasn't working.
The math was not working.
And that's what makes this paper such a cool detective story.
Yeah.
We have the suspect, this growing crystal. We have the laws of physics,
Right.
but the suspect keeps breaking the speed limit. And for a long time, nobody knew why.
Or rather, we thought we knew, but we were getting the wrong answers. So let's set the scene. We are talking about the transformation of steel from one phase to another.
Right. Let's unpack the basics. We start with hot steel. It's in a phase called austenite or gamma iron. And at this stage, it's happy, it's hot, and crucially, it's full of carbon atoms.
Austenite is very welcoming to carbon. Its crystal structure face center cubic has plenty of room to tuck those carbon atoms away. But as the steel cools, it becomes unstable. It needs to transform
Into ferrite, alpha iron.
into ferrite. And ferrite is the picky eater of the iron world.
Chuckles. That's a very good way to put it.
It has a body-centered cubic structure. It's tighter. It has almost no solubility for carbon. So imagine you're a tiny crystal of ferrite trying to grow inside this carbon-rich austenite.
Okay, so I'm surrounded by carbon atoms that I don't want.
Exactly. Every step you take, you bump into carbon. For the crystal to grow, for the interface to move forward, it has to physically shove those atoms out of the way.
It rejects them.
It rejects them into the surrounding austenite.
And that shoving takes time. The carbon has to diffuse or, well, swim away. So logically, the crystal can only grow as fast as the carbon can run away.
That is the definition of diffusion-controlled growth. The speed of the getaway driver determines the speed of the heist.
So this seems like a solvable math problem. I mean, in the 80s, scientists knew how fast carbon moves. They had the equations for diffusion.
They did.
They calculated how fast these ferrite plates, specifically this structure called Widmansdatin ferri, should grow. What happened?
The numbers were wildly off. Specifically, the theoretical calculations said these plates should be growing insanely fast, particularly at lower temperatures.
Exaggerated growth rates, I think Padatia calls it.
That's the term. The theory was overpromising. It said, hey, this crystal should be zooming along. But when they looked at the actual experiments,
It was much slower.
much slower. So you have this gap. And when you have a gap like that, you have to audit your inputs.
Right.
Padatia starts looking at the data everyone was using, and he realizes the culprit was something called empirical extrapolation.
Ah, the danger of drawing a straight line on a graph and hoping it just goes on forever.
It is the cardinal sin of data analysis. See, scientists had measured the diffusion of carbon at high temperatures. It's easier to measure there. Things happen faster.
Okay, so they had good data, but only for the hot stuff.
Exactly. But Widmansdatin ferrite grows at lower temperatures. So instead of measuring down there, which is hard, they just took the high temp line and, well, extended it down.
But nature rarely moves in a straight line.
Almost never.
Yeah.
By extrapolating, they missed all the subtle interactions happening when the atoms get cold and sluggish. They were plugging garbage numbers into good equations.
So Padatia comes in and says, stop guessing. We need a better model for how carbon behaves.
We do.
And this is where he brings in a concept that, I'll be honest, flew over my head the first time I read it, the Latcher-Fowler-Guggenheim model.
It sounds like a law firm, doesn't it?
It really does. If you've been injured by a phase transformation, call Latcher, Fowler, and Guggenheim.
But jokes aside, this model deals with something called configurational entropy. The paper makes a big deal about how the old models assumed the solution was ideal.
Can we break that down? What's an ideal solution?
So an ideal solution model assumes that the carbon atoms inside the iron are just bouncing around randomly, like strangers mingling in a park. They don't care who they are next to.
Okay, random mixing. Simple math.
But the Latcher-Fowler-Guggenheim model recognizes that these atoms actually have preferences. The mixing isn't random. Carbon atoms interact with the iron and with each other.
So it's more like a high school cafeteria than a park?
That is a perfect analogy.
There are cliques. There are people avoiding their exes.
Exactly. The configurational entropy is the mathematical way of describing that complex seating chart. If you don't account for those social preferences, your calculation of the energy state is wrong.
And if the energy is wrong, your diffusion prediction is wrong.
You got it.
So Boetius swaps out the simple random model for this sophisticated clique model. That fixes the mixture. But that wasn't the only thing the old calculations were getting wrong, was it?
Not even close. There's something even deeper hidden in the iron itself.
This was the aha moment of the paper for me.
Me too. It's easy to focus on the carbon moving around, but you have to look at the iron lattice too. To get the thermodynamics right, you need to know the specific heat capacity of the iron.
Which is basically how much energy the iron absorbs as you heat it up?
Yes. But here's the twist. In iron, that energy isn't just about vibrating atoms. There is a magnetic component.
Wait, hang on. We're talking about steel at like 700, 800 degrees Celsius? That magnet stopped working when they got hot.
They stopped being permanent magnets, yes. You can't stick a fridge magnet to hot steel. But the electrons, they're still doing a dance.
The dance.
In austenite, the iron atoms exist in two different quantum electronic states. A ground state, which is ferromagnetic, and a slightly higher energy state that is anti-ferromagnetic.
Quantum states. In a bridge weld.
It's inescapable. These two states are separated by a tiny energy gap, and the atoms are constantly flipping between these two magnetic personalities.
And the balance between them changes with temperature.
It does. And that change creates a magnetic component to the specific heat capacity.
And let me guess. The old researchers, the ones drawing the straight lines, they ignored this.
Completely. There were two main data sets at the time. One by Orr and Shipman, which was the standard. It just assumed a linear relationship.
And the other?
The other was by Kaufman. And Kaufman's data actually accounted for these magnetic states. Padeshi points out that at high temperatures, both data sets look the same.
But when you get down to the low temperatures where Widmanstad and ferric grows.
The Orr and Shipman data is dead wrong. The linear assumption falls apart. But Kaufman's magnetic model held up.
It's wild to think that to predict the strength of a steel beam, you have to account for the electron spin of the iron atoms.
You can't just be a metallurgist anymore. You have to be a quantum mechanic, too.
Okay, so let's take stock. We've cleaned up the crime scene. We stopped guessing about diffusion thanks to the LFG model.
Right.
We fixed the thermodynamics by respecting the magnetic personalities of iron. Now, surely we can predict how fast these crystals grow.
You would think so. But now that we've fixed the energy, we run into a geometry problem. If you want to calculate how fast something grows, you need to know its shape.
And we're looking at Widmanstätten ferrite. The pictures in the paper, they look like needles. Long, sharp spikes.
They look like needles in a 2D cross-section, sure. But are they needles paraboloids of revolution? Or are they plates parabolic cylinders?
Does it really matter for the math? A pointy thing is a pointy thing.
It matters hugely for diffusion. Imagine you're that carbon atom again. If the crystal is a thin needle, like a pencil, you can easily dodge to the left, right, up, or down.
Okay, so the carbon clears out quickly.
The crystal can grow fast. But if the crystal is a plate, imagine a surfboard moving edge first. It's much harder for you to get away. The carbon piles up.
So a plate naturally traps more carbon, which should slow down the growth.
Exactly. And Boetius argues pretty convincingly that these are plates. So he uses the parabolic cylinder math. But to solve that, you need one final variable.
How sharp the tip is.
The tip radius. A sharp tip cuts faster. A blunt tip cuts slower. But here's the problem. We can't measure the tip radius of a crystal while it's growing inside solid, red-hot steel.
It's impossible. So you have to assume something.
Enter Clarence Zener. He proposed the maximum velocity hypothesis.
I love this idea. It basically assumes the crystal is ambitious.
It assumes the crystal is an optimizer. Zener argued that the system isn't random. It will naturally adopt whatever tip radius allows it to grow as fast as physically possible.
Nature has a need for speed.
That was the prevailing thought. So Hodatia puts it all together. The plate model, the corrected LFG thermodynamics, and Zener's maximum velocity hypothesis. He runs this rigorous new model against the real experimental data.
Drumroll, please. Doesn't match.
No.
You have to be kidding me after all that work.
It is better. It is much better than the old junk that predicted growth rates that were impossibly fast, but there is still a systematic error.
What kind of error?
The theory now underestimates the growth rate.
Wait, let me get this straight. The old bad theory said they grew too fast, we fixed the data, and now the new good theory says they should be growing slower than they actually are.
Correct. The bad data made the old predictions overshoot. Now that we have good data, the math says, okay, given everything, you should only be able to grow at speed X.
But the real crystals are going faster.
They're going at speed X plus about 5 micrometers per second. They are breaking the speed limit.
5 micrometers per second doesn't sound like much.
In the microscopic world, it's a big deal. It's a systematic deviation. It suggests we are still missing something fundamental.
Could it be the shape again? The needle model?
He checks that. He runs the numbers for the needle model, just to be sure. But it's all over the place. It underestimates at low carbon, overestimates at high carbon.
So it's erratic.
Right. The plate model is consistent. It's just consistently too slow.
So the crystals are outperforming our best understanding of physics. Why?
Well, there is the displacive mechanism. We should mention that. This ferrite doesn't just grow by atoms wandering into place.
It grows by shear.
Like a deck of cards sliding, exactly. That crystal structure change is a mechanical deformation. It creates strain energy, about 50 joules per mole.
That sounds like it would slow things down, though, an energy cost.
It does, and Padicia accounts for it. But even with the strain energy included, the plates are still too fast in reality compared to the theory. So we have a mystery.
And this is where the paper takes a turn that I found really fascinating. In the conclusion, Padicia doesn't just say we need more data. He points to a flaw in the fundamental rule we used.
The maximum velocity hypothesis.
Yes.
This is the twist. He references work done on dendrites.
Those tree-like crystals that form when metal freezes.
Exactly. And in that field, researchers had recently proven that Zener's maximum velocity hypothesis is actually wrong.
So nature doesn't care about speed.
Nature cares about stability. It turns out the tip radius of a dendrite isn't chosen to maximize speed. It's chosen based on shape stability criteria. Basically, what shape can I hold without falling apart?
Okay, but how does that change the math for our steel plates? Well, here is the kicker. In those dendrite studies, the stable tip radius is larger. It's blunter than the maximum velocity radius.
And a blunter tip cuts slower.
Exactly.
Wait, if we apply that logic to our steel plates, if the real tip is blunter and slower than what Zener predicted, then our theoretical calculation should be even slower.
You see the problem.
But the real crystals are already growing faster than the theory. If we fix the hypothesis, the gap gets wider.
That is the bombshell in the outro. If we abandon maximum velocity, which we probably should, the discrepancy isn't 5 micrometers per second. It's huge.
That is slightly disturbing. It means the crystals are growing faster than diffusion allows, faster than stability allows. What is driving them?
That is the open question. He suggests the discrepancy might be because we're modeling them as perfect parabolic cylinders, while in reality, Widmanstätten ferrite is lath-like.
So the shape is still not quite right.
The shear component we talked about might change the diffusion geometry in ways we haven't modeled yet.
So we have peeled back layers of bad data and bad thermodynamics, only to find that at the core, we still don't fully understand the selection rules of nature.
It's frustrating, but it's also the best kind of science. This paper didn't close the book on steel. It cleared off the messy table so we could finally see the real puzzle.
And for the listener, why does this matter? Why care about a 5 micrometer per second difference in a crystal you can't see?
Because that growth rate determines the microstructure, and the microstructure determines the properties. If you're designing a high-strength, low-alloy steel for a deep-sea pipeline,
you need to know exactly how much of this ferrite is going to form in your welds.
Exactly. If your model is off, your safety margins are off. You might predict a weld is tough, but it turns out to be brittle. This paper gave us a rigorous baseline. It told us exactly how much we don't know.
It's like cleaning a dirty window. You might not like the storm you see outside, but at least you can finally see it clearly.
That is a perfect analogy. By stripping away the errors, Hodatia showed us that the simple carbon diffusion story while mostly true, isn't the whole story.
Well, I will certainly never look at a steel beam the same way again. I'll be thinking about those quantum magnetic states flipping and those ferrite plates racing against the speed limit that nature seems to be ignoring.
It's a good reminder that even in the most common materials, the stuff we build our world with, there are still deep mysteries.
I want to leave everyone with one final thought to mull over. We always assume nature follows the path of least resistance or maximum efficiency. But here, the crystal seems to be following a different rule entirely. If it's not optimizing for speed and it's not optimizing for stability in the way we think, what is it optimizing for?
That's the question.
Thanks for diving deep with us today.
A pleasure.
Stay curious, and we'll see you next time.